But we want to talk today about Dr. Paul Stephenson. And to begin with, I understand he came from a family of where the father was a minister.
Right.
Your father.
Right.
And what kind of minister and what denomination?
Disciples of Christ.
Uh huh.
And he started out as a saddlebags preacher down in Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
And then he worked in the state of Illinois setting up Sunday school church congregations. Had quite a number of places where he preached.
And one of the places was Monmouth, where Paul was born.
Paul mm-hmm. born there or married Paul, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then he eventually came to St. Louis to the Christian Board of Publication.
I see.
And was head of their editorial, Sunday school editorial department.
Was he in Chicago in the meantime between?
Yes, Mama? He was in Chicago.
Because there's reference to the fact that Paul went to school in Chicago too, mm-hmm. but most of Paul's schooling was in St. Louis, I trust.
Mm-hmm. I would say so. Yeah.
Uh-huh. At least his secondary.
Went to Hiram College from St. Louis, I'm sure.
Uh-huh.
And Hiram was a church college.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Disciples of Christ College.
Mm-hmm. Now, he took a Bachelor of Science at Hiram, to best of mm-hmm. my understanding. Did he also study for the ministry at Hiram?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he was mm-hmm. ordained.
I don't know where. Was he ordained at?
I'm not sure whether it was Hiram or later, but so he...
He came back then and entered the Washington University mm-hmm. for his medical education and did some preaching here, sort mm-hmm. of to work. He worked his way through both of them. I remember he said that he earned his way all the way through Hiram and through Washington.
Well, was it possible to become a minister in those days while you were doing your undergraduate work? Or did he have to go to specifically to a theological school afterwards?
No theological.
But this was a church college. I think mm-hmm. I think there was more ministerial training up there than there was a scientific training. Don't you?
Possibly
he always kind of laughed about that Bachelor of Science. he didn't quite know why that was a BS, but it was.
Well, I've written to Hiram College has an archives. I shouldn't mm-hmm. belittle it. It may be a very nice archives, and I've written to see if they have any information mm-hmm. to just verify the record, so we will mm-hmm. hopefully get a reply back from them.
A long time ago, be very interesting to see what they get. We went up to visit them in 1967 or 8, I guess, over the 4th of July. It's an interesting little town. It is.
It's all college.
It's
no
all
businesses.
No business in it at all. It was part of the Western Reserve, part of the state of Connecticut. Did
uh-huh.
you know that?
Yes,
in the early
yes.
time? Lots of people don't know that. And but there was the only place you could get groceries, a fair-sized little town. There were a lot of houses in it, a lot of people living there. But the only place you can buy groceries is at a little a communal place of some kind that's run by the college, I guess, non-profit. There's
uh-huh.
no commercial business at all in the little
community. We're going to smother if we don't drink it up.
It's so close to Cleveland that it could be just a bedroom community, but they safeguarded all that by uh-huh. having it really just a college.
Uh-huh. Was it there that he met his first wife at Hiram College?
No.
No, it was here, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. It was here.
Uh-huh.
Lucy knows those things better than I do.
Uh-huh. And her name was June?
Mm-hmm. June Lapsley.
Mm-hmm.
And she too was an ordained minister, is that?
No.
Well, there's a statement that I believe you gave Ms. Stephenson that they had a co-pastorate.
Yes, that's odd. I don't know what that was.
That's what I've never heard of.
Well, I got that from I guess the disciples, literature. They had a little article about Paul. I can get that. I don't have it right here. I should have perhaps. Paul always said there was a lot of guff in it.
Oh dear, don't mark that out. Don't ever put that.
Well, what about the church, I understand this was the Maplewood Christian Church?
Yes, he preached there.
And it still exists. I have an address at 2649 Oakview Terrace.
Uh-huh.
I've yet to call the pastor and verify that. June and Paul Stevenson had two children, Robert.
Twins.
And Margaret, and they were twins, and they were born just the... just on the eve of their departure, or not a year before their...
About a year before.
Before they left...
for China.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And Robert is living in California, and right. In San Andreas, and mm-hmm. Margaret is no longer living.
That's true.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. This is what that says. While Dr. Stevenson was receiving his medical training, his bride-to-be took her nurse's training in St. Luke's Hospital in St. Louis. After their marriage in 1914 and during the last 2 years of medical schooling, they held the joint pastorate of the Maplewood Christian Church.
Somebody dreamed that one up.
What is this document that you're... Oh, they went to China.
Yeah. Biographies of the Missionaries of the Disciples of Christ.
Hope he turned after receiving that.
Huh. Well, I'm wondering whether the church could... provide me with a copy, or perhaps...
Well, you might copy out that portion.
Okay.
There's only this little bit that...
Uh-huh.
Or is it here?
Pertains to
pages
down,
54 and 55 of,
mm-hmm.
of this book,
you
They
can,
Went to China.
Yes, you can take that. Paul thought that it was a little flowery in his giving him a little more credit than he wished to claim for himself. He was an excessively modest man. And he thought this was stressing the, in fact, it's, I think what really threw him is that it said at the end that he spends, this is after he's retired, I think, he spends a considerable portion of his time, you can hear Lucy laugh when I finish this, traveling through the length and breadth of the country, always carrying his bowl and chopsticks in the hope of encountering fellow exiles from China.
Come.
Yeah. this country with
this? Yes. He was always happy when he met someone who spoke Chinese and he could practice his Chinese a little.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Because
he didn't carry any bowl and chopsticks with him. That's ridiculous.
Whatever the particular details, he did support himself and his wife and then his children at by preaching at Maplewood.
Yes.
Christian Church.
His children, though, were born in 1917, weren't they? And they went to China in 17. So they were...
Those kids a year or so old before they went?
They weren't more than a year. I'll get up and go get their birth dates.
I guess you'd better.
I don't think I have that date exactly. They were married in 14, that says.
Well, now we have information that...
They were born in
1916.
In June of 16, and I don't remember
okay.
when in 17 they went to China, the exact date, I don't know. Okay.
Now, while Paul was still at the medical school, he learned from Robert Terry mm-hmm. of the opening at Peking Union Medical College.
Yes. What happened was that the Rockefeller Institute, the building, no buildings were there in Peking at that time, had decided to have the hospital. And they checked around at the various medical schools here and I think abroad to recruit their staff. And Dr. Terry recommended Paul.
Uh-huh.
That's how it happened.
I have a letter from Dr. Cowdery, who was in China, to Dr. Terry, I believe. Maybe he was not in China, but at any rate, a letter concerning the recruitment of somebody from Washington University,
well,
and I guess Paul was the candidate. Although he isn't mentioned in the letter.
Paul may never have known that. It might have been that Dr. Terry got in touch with him and didn't say where the information came from.
Uh-huh.
Something of that sort. But he said he went over to Brookings' home, which, you know, and there met someone from the Rockefeller people who asked him if he would be willing to go. But it would be a couple or 3 years before the school was built, and during that time, the Rockefeller people didn't want to handle his whole salary, but they did want him to be in China, and so they needed a missionary help, and since Paul was already part of in the folds of the church, they were willing to do that.
Well, apparently the Rockefeller Foundation took over Peking Union Medical College from a London missionary society, and in doing so they had to pledge that at least the character of the institution wouldn't change. It would no longer become a preaching missionary organ, but it would be some way, at least the spirit of the missionaries would be continued, so that they were...
That's news.
They were probably gratified to find somebody who had experience in both in both camps.
Of course, the Rockefellers were Baptists, very serious religious, and very anxious to improve their image because it had gotten pretty tarnished.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, a matter of doing two things at once. They were to educate the Chinese there, and eventually turn it over to the Chinese to operate. It was fully a philanthropic venture on their part.
Mm-hmm. Well, a year was spent in Nanking learning Chinese. So that was the first step. And from there they went to Luchaofu Christian Hospital, which would have been about 1918, and if they went to China
so.
In 17,
went there in 17,
then they would have been at the hospital in 1918, and if they came to Peking in 1920, then they were for 2 years at Luchaofu.
Yeah.
What memories or information are there about the Luchaofu experience? What kind of a place was it?
Just a good missionary station.
Yes.
They used to go up into the western hills in the summertime,
no,
not
they
there.
They went there after they went to Peking. But, well, he did a good deal of surgery there. And, what do I want to tell him? I can't think of my.
Well, was it a small hospital or?
Well, it would be in a mission station. It would be pretty elemental, I would think.
I don't remember him saying anything about operations that he performed on the people there, but undoubtedly there were. All I remember are things that he's told me about operating on some of the missionaries themselves, and on some of their living conditions and all that.
Was it supported by the Disciples of Christ or by other missionaries?
No, I think it was entirely Disciples of Christ.
Disciples of Christ.
Well, there's something in here that I don't know anything about. It says it's during this latter period, Dr. Stevenson's study and the publication of his findings concerning epidemic cerebrospinal meningitis, which was rampant in that part of China, forecast the direction of his subsequent professional career in China. Well, I don't think there's much to that, except that it may be of interest in that he was doing research of some kind there on his own, even in the beginning.
Well, this is again the publication, they went to China, and maybe it might make sense in terms of his interest in statistics, because epidemiology borders on being able to understand how large groups of population are affected by disease or whatever, or And certainly that was his later specialty, and because he tried to measure the characteristics of millions of people later on.
I think his interest was probably always scientific and science and research more than it was in clinical medicine.
Well, in Peking, he first became what was called an assistant in anatomy. Mm-hmm. And what did that mean? Do you have any idea what that position was?
I would think teaching and operating.
Teaching. I think he was teaching from the beginning.
He was teaching right from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. I would think so, don't you?
Yes, I think so. Mm-hmm. Operating was fairly incidental to the teaching. I think that was
I would think so. They were to teach the Chinese. That was the idea. They were really not to operate the hospital as a mission hospital. They were to teach Chinese to operate. And of course, that would involve doing a lot of operating of their own. But it was a teaching institution, I think. Although I get that impression on it.
Where's the picture?
What Paul himself said. It's in the other room. You can get it. It's on the table there.
Well, your biographical sketch. Mm-mm. Talks about the incident between him and Bertrand Russell. It's on record, so we don't have to go through that detail unless there's something that...
Paul was very amused by that always. There's a little cartoon that one of his students drew of him.
Yes. You gave us a copy of
one.
This.
One, not that one.
I think this one. Or
did I really?
Well, it's something that looks very, very much like
I
this.
Know you have another one that's a wonderful little caricature of him.
This is very close to it. In fact,
if it has the people
I'd like
in it,
to,
it's that one.
You know, use this in the article, but it shows them.
I thought maybe you would. That's why I got it out. If you already have it, fine. Paul said 10 years ago, 12 years ago, he could still remember all of these people and who they were. It's well drawn.
It's a caricature done by a Chinese student.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And it shows Paul Stevenson lecturing before them, and a copy of this, or one very, very close to it, is in the archive.
Uh-huh. Okay. If it isn't, I can get this to you, or you can take this now if you want to, whichever.
I think it looks so much, so close to, as I recall, but it will be reproduced in the article in Outlook magazine, and if it's so different, then maybe we can talk again, but hold on to it in the meantime. Mm-hmm. Do you recall how he got along with his colleagues of this medical school?
I think marvelously, because he loved it. He really liked the Chinese, you know, so much. And I would think that it was very good, because many of them wrote to him for a long time, and they wouldn't have done this. Get the other little thing that one of the other students gave him that's in there in the bookcase. Because there was so much work went into it, it couldn't have been done if they hadn't cared a great deal for him.
What about the Westerners among the faculty? For example, the men who were his superiors, namely Edmund Cowdery and Davidson Black.
Well, his relationship with Davidson Black was extremely close. That's a drawing. It may look like it's paste. It's a drawing.
This is a illustration or a
looks
picture
like
off the wall, but it looks like a collage, but you say it's not.
No, it's drawn in ink.
Uh-huh.
Even the stamp.
And it looks like various pieces of writing
paper.
With paper with Chinese calligraphy.
Mm-hmm.
On them, with the characters of various sizes and of various colors, and looked like the one they were torn
And it illustrates all of the different scripts of China over the several thousand years that Chinese script has been shown. A Chinese student of calligraphy could tell the years and periods when those were being used.
That's a very interesting object. If I may say, what you should do is inscribe this information on the back as you know it, so that
I suppose I should.
Yeah, so that's
and somebody else won't know it. Yes, that's
yeah.
true. That's true.
Others, meanwhile, stay healthy.
Right, by all means.
Now,
he worked many years in off and on, because the man came and went, with the famous French Jesuit paleontologist Pierre Teilhard de Chardin.
Right. That was a very close relationship, and it continued after he came back here to this country, and for quite a little while Pierre Teilhard was in New York. And that friendship was maintained. It was very strong, because Teilhard was having a very bad time with the with
church hierarchy.
The church, yes.
Yes, and he was very brokenhearted over the fact that he had been forbidden to teach. He was a devout Jesuit, but he did believe in evolution, and at that time the church did not.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a very sad situation, and June particularly was sympathetic and befriended him. I think Paul was probably working so much of the time that wasn't quite as close, but they were good friends during all that time. Paul was lucky in shortly after he got to Peking, I think, the Peking man was unearthed, and Davidson Black did most of that work.
Mm-hmm.
And Teilhard, of course, worked with him, and Paul worked right along with it there. I saw a picture a few years ago in the National Geographic of the diggings at Yucatan, and recognized Paul's figure there. Took it in and showed it to him, and yeah, I guess that is.
Well, you, among the pictures that you gave is one in which he's standing in the trench of the diggings. So this documented it's in photograph. Unless I'm badly misunderstanding the figure, it's surely
yeah.
him.
No, uh-huh. Well, I'm sure there was one, and
well, there were probably a great many, if National Geographic should also because he probably spent a good deal of time.
Well, he did, and he did a lot of the research work, and he always said that some of his advancement came because Davidson Black, or his opportunity to advance, because Davidson Black was so absorbed in this work that he didn't want to carry on all of his duties. And so Paul, I don't know whether it was official recognition of that or whether he just took over some of them. I don't know just how that was. They were very close, and when Davidson Black died, Paul, I think, gave the main oration. There was quite a memorial service for him. We have a bound copy of that.
Huh. Well, you gave one of those to me, so or at least to the collection. So we have that also on file. That's from 1934.
Mm-hmm.
But if we could return a little bit earlier, Paul returned to the United States to study at Western Reserve, and I believe it received a degree in 1922. But there's no evidence that I have immediately, although I've written to Western Reserve to find out what he actually studied at Western Reserve and why he returned.
It was in physical anthropology, I think, connection with bones principally. I know that he, at that time, he worked in the learning the ability to tell the age of an individual from the bones. They were digging up bones, and whose bones were these? How old were these people? Were they male or female? All you have, perhaps, is a leg bone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was the ability to do that sort of thing.
I see. Well, Davidson Black was a graduate of Western Reserve, so there's doubtless a connection that Black probably recommended Paul, and he went back to
him.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm sure he studied just what he needed for this work they were doing in China in excavations.
Mm-hmm.
Paul worked with that type of thing a great deal, bones there in China and to some extent here in this country. I don't know quite why, but he got locked into the Smithsonian connection with one.
Well, perhaps out of pure interest on his part.
Mm. Up with all the skulls.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there was eventually the collection that Dr. Terry assembled here at the medical school was given to the Smithsonian. I don't know whether would have happened, whether that was before Paul's death or not that was given, or I can't exactly tell you right at the moment.
There's I know Smithsonian people talk about a big collection of bones they have, and it was in the castle at that time, and the castle, you know, this main building,
yes.
Of the Smithsonian, kind of a little warren of funny little building, little rooms and offices, and this was clear up in the top somewhere. Paul said he was in Washington, just between planes, and he decided there was something he really would like to know about some of those skulls, and so he ran over to Smithsonian, and they just sent him on up. He'd been in the Smithsonian often enough, he knew people, I guess, many of them. He went on up to the room. And he got so engrossed in what he was doing that he forgot the time and suddenly realized that he'd overstayed his time. And it was after 5 o'clock and it was dark outside. And he went out and there was kind of an open shaft elevator. And he rang it and he looked down and he could see that down in the basement, he was here in the top, down in the basement, he could see an old chef, black, eating his supper or something, sitting down there. And he called down to him and asked him to come up. Well, Paul was blonde, and by that time I expect his hair was gray. I'm not sure about that. But at any rate, from up there where nobody ever was and where there were nothing but all these skeletons and bones and skulls, he said, it took a long time to get that fella to come up again.
Do you know what year that would have been?
No. Sorry, I don't.
Uh-uh. Well, that's an interesting story, yes.
It was funny.
Anyway. I imagine he was 2 or 3 shades lighter by the time he got up there, too.
A quarter or a real scare.
I don't think it was Dylan Ripley's time, because he didn't mention them. He said that later he was talking to whoever was in charge of the Smithsonian at the time, and he told him about it, and he said, well, you were just lucky it wasn't Friday or you'd have been in there until Monday. They didn't keep anybody overnight, over the weekend in the castle.
When he returned to Peking from Western Reserve, I guess he was received a promotion of sorts. I mean, he became an associate and then later associate professor, as opposed to
instructor, or whatever he used to call it.
That fits with what.
Yes, that's correct. There's a copy here that I got for the National Biographic Encyclopedia that has the facsimile from the of his salary and all that stuff. Wait a minute, maybe there's not what you wanted from Hiram here too, I don't know. But the promotion dates are there.
Oh, I see, yes. This makes it very explicit. But his graduation, or his climb up the ladder, so to speak.
I don't know. This is what that is.
These are official records from the schools. What we're talking about on Xerox.
That's right. They came from the China Medical Board, and then they got them. It says we've made copies of the cards we have in the office with this information.
Was the Reverend Marion Stevenson his father?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He's listed here. Is it possible that copies of these could go into the archives for the...
Yes, I don't see why you shouldn't take those, do you? We could We have no particular need of these. I don't know if I...
If you want copies, I can run down and get them.
They're not very good. I don't think we need them.
Would it be possible for me just to borrow them and make a copy of my own on my own machine?
Maybe you might do that. I don't know whether Paul's son might want these at some time or not. I doubt it, really.
I doubt it, too.
I doubt it. And,
I'll give you a receipt for...
Okay.
For the...
For whatever you take for lending. That'll be fine.
And mm-hmm. Along with the mm-hmm. book on mm-hmm. the Disciples of Christ that... Mm-hmm.
Yes, that'll be fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We assume that at Peking, Paul became interested in human evolution, owing to the just the
mm-hmm.
climate or the interest of mm-hmm. all his colleagues there. But the question I want to know is: did this represent a departure from the Disciples of Christ teachings?
I don't think so. I don't think the Disciples of Christ were. Even then, I don't think they were particularly bothered about anything like that. I don't think it did.
There were a lot of churches that were really very specifically anti-evolution.
Even now, that's true.
Disciples of Christ have their at least their headquarters in Tennessee, and that was where the Scopes trial took place.
No, their headquarters were not in Tennessee.
Well, at least their archives are, I think. Yeah, I think.
That's interesting.
I think
in
Nashville, or maybe they weren't there. I looked up the archives of the denomination, and that gave me a Nashville address, and I inferred from that that it was their headquarters.
You say did you look under actually Disciples of Christ or Christian Church?
Well, I looked, I think, under both, but this was identified as Disciples of Christ.
Well, that's interesting. There's a seminary in Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
but they've always
been... And Bethany, West Virginia.
They've been liberal...
From the time Alexander Campbell started it, I think.
Yes, and the Christian Board of Publication here in St. Louis, more or less... I would be surprised they didn't have archives here. I don't know. That's interesting.
Was there any time that Paul said that I'm breaking with the Disciples of Christ?
Well, no, I don't think so. He didn't serve actively or work actively in the Disciples of Christ at any time when I knew him, but. I don't think he ever opposed them in any way. The rest of the family ministers all over the place in the Stevenson family, the Disciples of Christ, and I don't...
Okay, it would be wrong to infer, put it this way, that having mixed with all these evolutionists in Peking, that he was going to throw over the church doctrines or...
I don't think he ever thought that... The church doctrine really depended on not believing in evolution. He sort of outgrew the church, I think. Even in those days, the reason the Bertrand Russell thing is so funny is because he idolized Bertrand Russell. And, of course, he was disturbed that Bertrand Russell would be so anti-American, though he understood why. But that's why that thing was so funny, really, that Bertrand Russell put him down so firmly what he was.
Apparently, I looked at a book titled The Problem with China by Bertrand Russell, and many of the kind of attitudes that he expressed to Paul directly, Russell wrote again in this book. And so that it was something that was, maybe he was used that moment to formulate some of his attitudes toward Americans in China.
I don't know.
It's interesting. He doesn't mention Paul in the book, to be sure. But
it's a minor irritation in Russell's life.
Oh, yes. I'm sure he met so many people in his career.
Paul did do a lot of other things besides his work there at the college because he was so interested in anthropology, and a lot of anthropologists were coming in there to Peking, and he knew Houghton and Svenna Dean, who was tracing out the Silk Road, and Anderson, who was in Search of Man, and
Gunnar, Johan Gunnar Anderson, yes.
I don't remember.
Roy Chapman Andrews, two of
them. Yes, Roy Chapman Andrews. Paul knew all those people and met them all as they came through China, probably entertained them, liked them all. It was Houghton who told him that he should always go alone on his expeditions, and he tried hard to do that. But he seemed, he was president of the Peking American Society for a good long time, and those contacts meant that he entertained and was entertained by and knew all these people. He made these expeditions. Bouton, who was from the British Museum, very fine individual, went on a trip with him. Paul had to take him, in fact.
Take care of him, too.
and take care of
too
him.
Too much horseback riding.
What was this gentleman's first name?
Bouton? I don't know.
And he was an anatomist or an anthropologist?
Well, he was, I guess, an anthropologist. I don't know that for sure. He was with the British Museum.
I see.
And he came to China interested in scientific things. Whether he was something of an artist, I don't really know. You can look him up because he's a famous man.
You know how the name would be spelled?
B-O-O-T-O-N.
Okay, all right. I think I've seen it.
Wait a minute, it's Buxton, B-U-X-T-O-N, isn't it?
Well,
it's spelled that way.
I'm not sure.
Yes, I'm sorry, that's very stupid of me. It's B-U-X-T-O-N, and I don't think I have it anywhere. But it would have been about that time, around 1920, 1930. Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned the Swedish explorer Sven Hedin,
mm-hmm.
and in the written sketch of Paul's life, you indicated that Paul went to Stockholm.
Yes.
At mm-hmm. some time. Do you know when that was?
Lucy, do you know? They came through here and went on to...
probably mid-30s.
So it was some time when he went on sabbatical. It wasn't the year that he left China for...
No.
In 1937. No. It was before 1937.
It would be before that. Yes,
it would have been before that. Been before the war.
And it was it the same year that he went to London?
No.
No.
It was after that. I think he had a sabbatical 1 year and four. That was pretty good. Be for a whole year.
I see.
Always spent it in... research or work of that kind.
Uh-huh.
And it was, I really don't know. Whether it could have been in 37, he was on his way here in 37 when the Japanese went in. He was on the Pacific at that time, on his way east. West, east, and
I've written to Sweden. I have some contacts there, and I've we'll find out. I wrote specifically for information because there is a large collection of materials that Sven Hedin left, maybe there is somewhere some file that has the name of Paul Stevenson on it.
Oh, I'm sure you'd find it.
Who was the other chap?
Hummel. Dr. Hummel was one of the men who was with Sven Hedin. I don't remember, I know his initials. But Sven Hedin was the leader of that. He wrote a lot of books. He kind of fell in disfavor during the war because he supported the Nazis.
Yes.
So he wasn't quite as much of a hero afterward.
Uh-huh.
But this was before that time, so it wasn't known.
Well, he did a credible amount of exploration in Central Asia.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first European, I think, to enter vast tracts of territory.
Yeah.
And he also had this facility for writing very interesting popular books that were translated. So.
That's right.
Up in the mountains.
We read them all.
Yeah, we have his travels up on the shelf with him.
And then some of them, most of them were given to Bob. But.
Let's go back to the incident with Sun Yat-sen. Did Paul have contacts with Sun before the fatal illness?
I don't think so much with Dr. Sun, but he was, of course, a patient there in the hospital. This is how he probably saw him. But the Sung sisters, you see, were educated here at Wellesley, and they became close friends of Paul and June, and were often there at the house. And Paul said they kind of liked once in a while to get away from their Chinese political background, let their hair down a little.
Yes, they had been so thoroughly westernized by their education in Massachusetts that although they remained certainly Chinese to the end of their lives, they probably enjoyed companionship of an American family.
That's right.
Were there, of course, ultimately the sisters
split.
Very much. One, the Madame Sun Yat-sen went to Communist China, or remained in Communist China, and of course Madame Chiang Kai-shek went with her husband to Taiwan. But Paul knew them both.
There's a letter there in the archives from Madame Chiang Kai-shek. Said, "Dear Paul, we don't know what we'd have done without you," and all that kind of stuff. Yes, they were good friends, and so I think that probably is how Paul got involved in the embalming of Sun Yat-sen. Incidentally, you have in the archives there a couple of things you shouldn't use for publication. They're very restricted for that. In connection with the disappearance of Sun Yat-sen's liver in the autopsy, so don't include anything about that. That's sensitive to the Chinese government. They made terrible accusations against the PUMC for destroying Sun Yat-sen's body and so on and so forth.
I see.
But the embalming was a difficult thing to do because the body had been autopsied. And when they found that they wanted, the Chinese wanted it preserved under glass like lemons, you know, it was a problem as to how to do that. And Paul somehow or other got involved in that, and they had to work out that method, and then he had custody of the body for those 2 or 3 years till they got the tomb built in Nanking. There's a full account of that in the archives. I didn't realize that when I was talking to you, but there is.
Yes.
Because after all those accusations were made, the China Medical Board, which is part of the Rockefeller operation, had decided that while some of these people were still living, they should gather the facts, all the facts that they could, together. And so they asked Paul to write these and to review the ones that other people had written and send them back to him. And he did that, and that's how I happened to learn what I did about those things. So you have copies of two of those letters.
Yes, that is correct, and they are in the archives. We've already established, well, let me go on first of all to the year in London with Carl Pearson. Carl Pearson was a mathematician who applied his mathematical formulas to try to prove evolution, I understand.
I didn't know.
That was, I think, one of his main claims to fame. To the best of my knowledge, Pearson used lower life forms like crabs and statistics that could be done from other animals of that,
really?
Of that sort. And it's just interesting that, of course, Paul was interested in human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, this approach to statistical, the statistical approach to evolution was something that evidently interested in him enough to want to go to London.
Mm-hmm. And I think he wanted to learn how to do the statistical work. I understood that from something he said that Pearson is the man who worked out this measurement of the skin surface of a human being from the height and weight. Those tables, that's a very valuable thing in the medical profession. I think at that time, at least, metabolism was based pretty much on the amount of skin surface.
Mm.
And it differs from the Asiatic people from the Occidental. And if Pearson had done it for the Occidental, and once done, it's done. And it's used by everybody after that. And Paul did it then for the
Chinese.
Mm-hmm. For the Chinese, Japanese, and so on. I think that's was one of the achievements. I think all those, you've got a whole bunch of reprints and whatnot.
Yes.
There of some of those things, or the tables of skin measurements and surfaces.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, it's just a mess of statistics. It doesn't mean anything to me. But
I'll have to look at them again in view of what you've told me. In 1934, Paul received the Order of the Blue Jade from the Chinese government.
Mm-hmm.
Was this in connection with this, the embalming of Sun Yat-sen?
I think so. All I have is a very minor thing somewhere in here, that it was for services rendered to the Chinese government. And I think that was what it was in connection with keeping the body, I think, and embalming it and getting it in the casket. It read, this is from a diploma that was given in connection with the citation, the Order of the Blue Jade, and it reads, by the national government, the Order of the Blue Jade, for the part, this is Paul's quotation, I guess, for the part I had played in connection with the preservation and care of the body of Sun Yat-sen.
Hmm.
The body he had played. It's my writing, and I don't know just how I took that off. He sent that to Harold Laux, and it's in the collection of the China Medical Board. Well, they would have the exact wording of that.
Well, that's now open to researchers, so that one of these days I will have the opportunity, I hope, to go to New York and look at these collections.
In 1973, Mary Ellis was secretary there. That's E-L-L-I-S, Mary Ellis. Mary Ferguson is a person that I had met there.
Mm-hmm.
Her title is on this or not.
She was, I believe, the registrar of Peking Union Medical College, and then wrote a book.
I think that's
a history of the college that we have in the in the library.
Mm-hmm.
The China Medical Board and the Peking Union Medical College, I think, is the title.
That'd be interesting.
I come down someday. Can I get it and look at it?
Well, I have it checked out now, but when I put it back.
Oh, that's all right. It'll take me forever to get there, probably. But it would be very interesting.
Davidson Black died of a heart attack in 1934, and Paul, I guess, was one of the first to discover the body.
I think that's probably true.
He and Teilhard de Chardin were in the same building, and
a terrible shock to him.
There were some people that thought that Paul would succeed to the head of the anatomy department, but he didn't. What was he passed over?
I have no idea. He never mentioned it to me at all.
It was a Dr. Fortune from Holland that mm-hmm. became the head of anatomy after, I think. Mm-hmm. No, there was also a Dr. Wiedenreich from a German scholar who was.
I've heard Paul speak of both of them. Dr. Fortune died not so very long ago. I don't know how many years ago. I remember an invitation to the memorial service came.
Maybe Paul slant toward anthropology more than.
I think that's probably true. That
probably responsible for that.
The amount of research work he was mm-hmm. doing and all that.
Yeah, that does make sense because I think mm-hmm. they were the Rockefellers were kind of suspicious of Davidson Black being so interested in the skulls mm-hmm. when he ought to. Mm-hmm. But they expected somebody to be teaching anatomy for the mm-hmm. point of view of a medical student. Mm-hmm.
It and could be that the Rockefeller Baptists too didn't approve too much of it. I don't know. I never heard anybody say anything about it. Paul never said anything about it.
There was a famous sculptor named Malvina Hoffman in China at this time, she was doing work on the statues that are now on display at the Museum mm-hmm. of Natural History in Chicago, the Hall of Man.
Paul helped her some there. Mm-hmm.
She came to him looking for a sort of scientific basis mm-hmm. for these, what for her were kind of artistic mm-hmm. sculptures. Mm-hmm. So he was a consultant on these, mm-hmm. on the creation of these works insofar mm-hmm. as they represented mm-hmm. Chinese. You indicate in your biographical sketch, Mrs. Stevenson, that Paul worked on a manuscript that would have been his chief work, a mm-hmm. work on the racial origins of the Chinese, mm-hmm. and that this was lost in mm-hmm. in Manila in 1941. Mm-hmm. Do you know when he began work on that study?
No, I don't know anything more about it than that. It was always difficult to get any information from Paul. I tried hard, and I tried so hard to get him to write these things, because he wrote well. And he said, that's past, and it's what's ahead, what's now, and what's ahead that's important. Nobody's interested in all this old thing. Uh-huh. And I couldn't find out much. I found out more from the things that were packed away after he died, and uh-huh. I found out from him.
Uh-huh.
He was not interested in looking back.
Uh-huh.
Not interested in talking about his achievements like some people do.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And he didn't think much of people who did talk about them.
Well, some of us professional historians, of course, that's all we can do. Maybe we don't talk about ourselves, but we don't.
I blame myself now for not having needled him more about it.
Well, as we've already discussed, he was on sabbatical and en route to the United States in 1937 when Peking fell to the Japanese. Yet Americans and others continued to live in Peking and were not barred by the Japanese from Japan and China because war did not break out for another 4 years or more.
That's right.
Yet Paul didn't return to China. Yeah. Why not?
The Rockefeller people would not send him back.
They decided that it was mm-hmm. time to begin to withdraw from Peking so that they weren't going to put any more. Yes. Those that were already there could stay,
the others would not go back. And he was under contract. They paid his salary through 1941. I think that thing tells when they stopped it, that little thing he took. But they kept it. They paid his salary, but did not send him back.
It's strange that there were visiting professors that went there because one of the deans of the medical school here, a man who had been a dean at this medical school, Eugene Opie, went to China after It was under the control, the Peking area was under the control of the Japanese, and I think he was there in 1939, 1940.
To get interned?
Yeah, no.
No, he left just before the internment. Well, I can't answer that at all, except that they were very good to him and kept his salary coming, and I used that time then to go to Johns Hopkins and so on.
In the meantime, he went to, he was in Cincinnati for a time, I believe.
Yes.
This would have been, if he left China in 37, he must have gone to Cincinnati that
I
year.
Think so.
And then was so. There for a year. And the records indicate he was a research fellow in medical center administration.
I think you have everything I have on that.
So that must have been a temporary position.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, it was. I don't think there was any salary in connection with it. I don't think I have anything more than what you have.
Well, then he went on to Johns Hopkins. And
yes.
He studied, it was public health.
That's right. I think there's always a sort of major in public health, and his was in the mental health.
Field
side of it. Now maybe you don't have this. This is
all right. This is a letter from the University of Cincinnati Medical Center dated March 7th, 1973. And you asked them to check records about Paul, and it says September 27, 1938, appointed research fellow in medical center administration, concurrently assistant to the dean, to serve for 1 year without salary. All right, and then he was getting his money from the Rockefellers,
right?
And so that this was
a
charity, in effect, a kind of
right. I don't know how he happened to go there or anything about that.
Why did he choose the mental health field?
I think because his daughter was not well. His daughter had, they were twins of two children. And the daughter and adolescents developed loss of hearing and loss of eyesight. Was thought to have been part of the prenatal condition.
Uh-huh.
One of those unavoidable things. And when this happened to her, I think she was probably about, well, it was a gradual thing, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Uh-huh.
But by the time she was 16 or so, her mind had begun to be altered by it. It's an understandable thing, but evidently it was schizophrenia, and there wasn't much that could be done. And it was a great tragedy because she had been a very talented and very lovely young girl. Well, Paul became very interested then in mental health. He had always, his prize the Gill Prize for Anatomy, that had been
yes.
In neuroanatomy.
Uh-huh.
And so I think he'd always been interested in the brain, and I think it probably came from that phase.
I see. Mm-hmm. Well, was it with reluctance that he was called back to Asia after he...
He had gone, I think what you have in here is not exactly correct, because when he came, I may be wrong. I thought that he joined the public health service when he came out of Johns Hopkins
mm-hmm.
and had just gone into it when the Chinese government asked our government for help in guarding the health of the coolies who were going to build a Burma railroad to supplement the highway. The highway had not been very satisfactory. It was terrible terrain, I guess. And Roosevelt agreed to this, and I suppose checked with the Department of Public Health. The government had asked, the Chinese government had asked for Paul because he spoke Chinese. Mm-hmm. And of course they knew him, you see.
Yes.
Chiang Kai-shek would have known him.
Uh-huh.
And so they had asked for him particularly, and he was already in government employment, as I understand. So that he didn't, he could have refused, I suppose, but he loved the Chinese. It was a chance to go back, it was a chance to help them. And I remember that he was quite enthusiastic about going.
Mm-hmm.
They came here on Thanksgiving, for Thanksgiving, and got a call from Washington to go right away. And they left before Thanksgiving. And it was kind of a hurry-up trip.
Well, this time he left without the family.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Even though they were not yet... War, it was not yet
war
between the United States and Japan.
Mm-hmm. It was pretty imminent.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people on the plane, the pilots were carrying secret orders and all of that mm-hmm. sort of thing. And they went faster than they had expected to go. He had expected to have some time in Hawaii and in the Philippines, where he had friends in both places, but they went faster.
That's mm-hmm. where the manuscript of his book disappeared.
In Manila.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, then once the war began, of course, he was in effect stuck in
Burma,
in South Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a, and he was there until 1944.
Mm-hmm. I guess so.
And this is documented in the history
of
the United States Public Health Service.
Yes, I just forgotten this one year. Well,
that we have in our library.
Yes.
That the proper citation will be entered into the record at a later time.
Mm-hmm.
But he returned to the United States in 1944. And, to work with the National Institutes of Health.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You see, he was released, of course. He was still in government service, and he would be released from the military service back to his...
Well, this is the continuation mm-hmm. of our conversation with Mrs. Stevenson and Miss Stevenson concerning Paul Stevenson. And we had gotten, I believe, to the end of World War II when we were last speaking, but I want to backtrack for a moment and ask about Ramgarh, India, where Paul was with American forces after they were forced to evacuate from Burma. And I looked on the map and I saw a number of Ramgarhs.
It was in Assam, and I think that is in about the northeast corner of India, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Okay, well clears up the matter, because I remember one of the Ramgarhs was in Assam, but there was one in Bengal, and
yes,
there was one
right.
on the other side of the...
Well, he was close to Calcutta, wasn't he?
He went down to Calcutta at various times, but I don't think that this is too near it.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the part that rained so terribly, and it's so hot.
Mm-hmm.
I know
he probably
that.
Had a monsoon type climate. Probably very much like that part of Bangladesh that gets flooded only further inland from what is now Bangladesh.
I remember a letter he wrote home at the time that said he knew what it was like to have prickly heat over his entire body.
My goodness.
That the temperature was at 117 and it stayed there and wet. Bad. Terribly hot.
Today we've been complaining about temperatures in St. Louis at around 95.
That's right.
And it would be considered a cool day by comparison. Yes.
It must have been quite bad. He always said that we were so fortunate in this country in having weather that changed every 5 days or so. Of course, the present one hasn't changed in 5 days, but generally it does. And there, it would either rain continuously for weeks on end, or it would be dry and hot for weeks on end, that kind of thing. He said it results in a lethargy that we don't know anything much about.
Mm-hmm. Well, back in India, he was far removed from the people that he thought he would be treating the Chinese, so I imagine he had very little contact with the Chinese.
I think that's true. Stillwell was there occasionally, but I don't think too frequently. These were troops. These were Chinese troops, weren't they?
Not in Rangar, I don't think.
Anyway, the troops were being
maybe
trained for use at Stillwell. Now, you can verify what Stillwell was doing there. Not in any account of Paul's, but he had a plan for I'm not sure enough to say now, I should remember. I don't think they intended to do anything more to try to get back the Burma Road, but for something or other, and he was training troops, and part of these were American troops, but I don't know that they all were.
Mm-hmm. They may have been some British, some possibly some Indian.
Uh-huh. They had Indian servants, and they had a terrible time with them because they were not clean, and they couldn't get them to wash their hands. I know he said that. Finally, a sergeant reported one day that he had out of his own money bought some horrible perfumed soap, and from then on the Indians washed their hands. They liked the smell of that.
To get the perfume, but not to get clean. Well.
But they had their disease problems there, and what he was doing was looking after the health of the camp.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say in the biographical sketch that you wrote that he returned to the United States in 1944, and from June 1944 until the end of the war, he participated in a series of seminars held at universities of Virginia, Princeton, and Yale. And in this capacity, he instructed men who were to be sent to govern the territory surrendered to the Allied forces.
I think that's right.
Do you recall any details about that period? This would have been public health issues?
He was still in the Army, I think. I can verify all that from papers here. You'll excuse me for a moment. I'd better do it.
The only thing I can think of in those terms, of course, is the what happened after, just what ended the war, namely the bomb. Do you recall him saying anything about the explosion of the atomic bombs? He made no special...
No, I guess he had seen so much war that
yes,
a bigger blast didn't mean that much.
Yeah, I think we have to think of that in that certainly in that context, people fully thought that it would save lives rather than do anything else. At any rate, he worked within the National Institutes of Health in that period. Was this not the case?
Yes, I think so. Eventually. He was in charge of the alcoholic program and trying to set up the universities and schools to try to have some bearing on the problems.
This would, of course, been after the war, and then he focused. Is there anything else that you recall him saying about the expectations of governing post-war
China?
Asia or China?
Mm-hmm. It'd be speculation on my part. Uh-huh. I hope Helen can come up with some things. Uh-huh. We still have some material. Uh-huh. And you've been through everything down there, I expect.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Did he say anything about the conflict between the nationalists and the communists? Was that an issue that...
Someplace or other, he seemed to mention that the Chinese communists were an entirely different breed than the Russian communists. Their uh-huh. whole bent was agriculturally minded. Uh-huh. But that's about all that I remember.
The Chinese communists long... some years even before the war broke out, of course the war broke out between the Japanese and the Chinese mm-hmm. already in the early 30s, but by this time the communists were forced into the western hinterlands, the so-called Long March, you mm-hmm. recall, and so that mm-hmm. people like Paul Stevenson perhaps did not have any direct contact with them, except for maybe covert agents mm-hmm. or something that he
yeah,
may not.
Yeah, I doubt if he did, really, because after he and Stillwell got out of Burma, why, then his emphasis was military down in Ramgar.
I see Mrs. Stevenson has a group of documents. Maybe we can flip this machine to pause for a moment to check it.
It doesn't seem. I thought that this would have the date of it.
When last we were speaking, Mrs. Stevenson brought forth a diary that Paul had apparently compiled at the end of the war, and it has a lot of miscellaneous notations. Some humorous notations, but at least one portion of it looks very interesting in that he was giving some thought to ideal or proposed military organization in occupied territories, mm-hmm. and for someone like himself who was engaged in that very problem. It could be a valuable document, and we hope someday that it'll be part of the archives.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Well then, we came to the end of the war,
mm-hmm.
and still working for the National Institutes of Health, or at least back now to a civilian status. Wouldn't you say? Would this be correct?
Not exactly, because I suppose it is. He was one of the what they call the professional corps of the public health, which was on a military basis always.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are two ways of belonging to the public health. One when you're a member of the civil service, and one in which you're the professional corps.
I see.
And that is why he didn't enlist in the Army, and he was not drafted uh-huh. in the Army. He could simply be uh-huh. reassigned.
I
to
see.
It.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. so he was in this latter capacity, and he had the equivalent of a rank of colonel.
Mm-hmm. That is right. Uh-huh. And then when he returned to the what you would call a civil status, it was as medical director. See, that's the same rank as colonel.
I see.
Except
I
that
see.
It's public health. Professional corps mm-hmm. rank, and I had that date here, and I don't know if you have it or not. That's what I was looking for at the time that he was transferred. He's separated from.
Well, there's one other statement that you made while we were pausing that might be worth entering into the record here, is that it was the death of his father which was the immediate occasion of his taking leave from the mm-hmm. China-Burma-India mm-hmm. theater, mm-hmm. and he didn't return to Asia after this?
No. We better get that straight. He was already back in the States.
In 44. So he had come as a regular relief of the officer.
He was still in the military classification, because during that time that he was lecturing at these various universities, that was under military status.
I see. Uh-huh.
And it was after that that he was returned to the public health non-military, and that date was the 3rd of July, 1952.
Oh, I see. So it was substantially after this period. Okay.
Yes, this document says that he remains on active duty in non-military status in the public health service.
I see.
And that date is the 3rd of July, 1952.
Well, when did he become actively and full-time engaged in the problem of alcoholism and conducting the university teaching centers on alcoholism?
That's right. I've got that date in here somewhere. January 22nd, 1957.
Oh, so this is still further into the future. Well, what kind of work did he engage in the late 40s then?
It was about the time the National Institutes of Health were being activated, and he joined in what was the National Institute of Mental Health, which was part of the National Institute, was just being formed. Dr. Felix, Robert Felix, was head of that, and Paul was an assistant. I think there were very few people, and their first assignment was to try to determine how many medical schools and had classes in psychiatry, degrees in psychiatry, and how many, the status of mental institutions generally. They were warehouses for the most part. You went and you stayed there all your life. And after that survey was made, that took him to most of the states in the United States, and all of the medical schools, of course. Very few of them had courses in psychiatry. And he didn't ever get to Puerto Rico, but this was his assignment at any rate. And following it, and with the report, they got enough money from Congress so that they could give grants to schools, universities that were willing to begin classes in psychiatry and that kind of thing. I was very proud of the eventual results of this when, I don't remember the year, when the first, for the first time there were more people leaving the institutions for the insane than were entering it.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, they're taken for granted that you can be confined for a time and you can get well and you can go out again. And every medical college of any status has psychiatric.
Mm-hmm. So in a word, he was in a very crucial, in public health psychiatry, in a very crucial period of its development.
Just beginning, that is right.
Mm-hmm.
And his mental health degree was a specialty in psychiatry, and he didn't ever practice psychiatry as a psychiatrist, didn't ever do his residency, because his degree was in public health, not in psychiatry, but he had the training.
Mm-hmm.
All of the training that a psychiatrist would get, except the residency.
Was his interest more in administration?
This would be the administrative side, entirely.
I see. Uh-huh.
The National Institute, I don't think, I don't really know this, but you can verify it, I don't think that they have any, do any clinical psychiatry. I think they give grants to and have some administrative influence over. And he did that, and I think he was still doing it when the accident occurred. And I don't know the date of the accident. You don't either, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
You mean the
accident which his first wife was killed in 1954?
Yes.
You mentioned.
Right. I have the date from that. And he was ill, and he was retired shortly after that. That retirement date is in somewhere 55, I guess, something like that. He took retirement.
Uh-huh.
And
did he in any way participate, just because you mentioned Korea later, he didn't participate in the Korean War?
No.
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 He was in the United States during the Korean conflict.
Yes, and I don't, yes, that is right. And I was looking for the actual retirement date here. I was retired on 1/1/55.
Uh-huh.
And he was recalled to active duty on 1/22/57.
I see.
And assigned to the National Institutes of Public Health, and that was to head the Department of Alcoholism.
I see.
Which was still in the National Institutes of Mental Health.
Uh-huh.
But of course it now is a separate one. That was done after his final retirement.
Uh-huh.
He went to Korea in that interval when he was retired.
I see. So he worked in a private capacity for the American Korean Foundation.
That's
in
right.
From
mm-hmm. That's
1955
right.
to 1957.
Yes. He wasn't there so awfully long because he'd always had trouble with his back, serious trouble. And Korea was very badly torn up, of course, after the war, dreadful shape. He spent most of his time on horseback getting around through the country, and he had serious trouble with his back and had to come home invalided.
Well, it must have been very painful to someone with a problem like that to be on a horse or on a jeep, for that matter, when the roads were so very...
So he wasn't there so awfully long, and I don't know just how long. There's nothing in the files here. He didn't keep any notes that we ever saw. They were probably torn up at some time or other.
But the survey in Korea was with respect to hospital and health needs of Korea.
What should be done to set up adequate health facilities for a war-torn country?
I see.
Pretty much demolished.
Well, then he returned to the United States, and you mentioned that in 1954 his first wife was killed in an automobile accident, which he was very seriously injured. Mm-hmm. And in 1957, you, Mrs. Stevenson, married him.
You
right?
Married October 56, I think. Is
oh,
that
I see.
The date you have? I think that's right.
Yes, late in 1956 you were married,
mm-hmm.
and then,
mm-hmm.
okay. Well, I take it that you were known him for a number of years already.
Yes, because I lived with the Stevenson family. I had come here to St. Louis as a young widow and had come to help look after an elderly aunt. And after she was joined a retirement home, I went to live with the Stevenson family, and Lucy's father just considered me as one of his children, though I wasn't adopted. And so I knew Paul occasionally, saw him occasionally when he and his wife would be coming home, and I saw their letters and that kind of thing. I didn't know him very well, but I knew him as I would a brother.
I see. Where and this was in St. Louis that you lived. Did you live in St. Louis at the time too, Miss Stevenson?
Yes.
Where would this, what part of the city would that have been?
West End.
Uh-huh.
Over on Julian.
I see.
And Enright, when I knew.
And then Enright later on.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you joined a family in about, 31 or 2? Around in there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I can well understand it's the personal knowledge that you add to much of the wartime story. It makes that much more clear. Mm-hmm. Well, then, as you say, Paul Stevenson was worked with as a mental health consultant in alcoholism. Mm-hmm. From 1957 until his retirement in 1960. Mm-hmm. Did he travel much in this capacity?
Yes, almost entirely in connection with it, giving lectures and of course, again, arranging with what was being done in various places, and there were grants given again, I don't know just what he did do.
Did he go to medical schools or
yes,
to help,
it would be,
other kinds
yes,
of
schools? Yes, there was a great attempt then to try to get medical schools to be interested in alcoholism. They hadn't been. It's kind of hard to remember now the way that situation was. Doctors didn't want drunks in their waiting rooms. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to deal with
it. They didn't consider it a sickness.
That's right. And it was there was a feeling, Paul always said, that these were people who were unattractive and you just preferred to turn your back on it. And
it was a social problem. Of course,
right.
Everybody knew
that's
that.
Right.
Of course, the mm-hmm. Volstead Act had put that in much across to people's mind, but it's to this day the whole issue of the intoxicated driver and whether mm-hmm. there ought to be stiffer mm-hmm. penalties mm-hmm. against drivers who are under the influence mm-hmm. is still hotly debated. People mm-hmm. as though it were right, people's mm-hmm. right to be on the road if they're mm-hmm. Drunk.
But at that time, it was just really no help for them. The police would arrest them, and here in St. Louis would take them down under the Free Bridge and dump them. And just get them out of sight, or if they locked them up, they put them in the jail, they let them go as soon as they were sober. And when they went out and got drunk again, and you know, it was a revolving door sort of thing. So out of it now, you know, there are plenty of places where people can go to be rehabilitated. And even industry, at that time they were trying also to interest companies in having some kind of alcoholic counseling. Well, it's no problem for us. But then eventually they began to find that it was a problem, sometimes involving people quite valuable to a company originally. But that was the type of work being done. It meant meeting with industry, and it meant meeting with the medical schools, with medical societies where doctors who were practicing, that type of thing, trying to get courses in alcoholism set up, but that kind of thing. He was the only person involved in it for quite a little while, with a secretary, and then he finally had one assistant who took over when he was retired, and I lost track of it after that. I think it was two or three years after that, probably after Paul died, that it became a separate department in Washington.
Were you based in Washington at the time, or did you?
He was at the time, yes. Not in the city of Washington,
but in Bethesda.
Well, it was actually in Silver Spring, but it was an extension of Bethesda. Hmm. Bethesda is so crowded that they had large offices in Silver Spring, which is not very far from Bethesda.
Where did you have your home?
He was living in Baltimore.
I see.
Mm-hmm. He stayed in Baltimore for quite a little while. I was working at Union Electric, and I wanted to stay until I could retire.
I see.
I could retire at 55, and I had just a few years, and he was on the road too much.
Uh-huh.
So for a little while, we were a separate married couple. I would fly down on weekends. I could leave the office at 5:10, I guess, and get to Washington by 7:30
uh-huh.
and meet me there, and come back on late Sunday night or Monday morning. And if he was anywhere in the western part of the United States, he could come here over a weekend. So that was the way we we did that for a few years.
So you, as a rule, did not travel to these various seminars and meetings. Let me ask you, Miss Stevenson, were you a career woman?
Well, 40 years at Ralston Purina, would you call that a career?
Yes, I would say that, yes. Were they downtown at the time?
Yes.
That was before, obviously, they built the checkerboard square tower, and now is their headquarters.
Yes, the tower came into being after I retired. Uh-huh. I've been retired at least 18 years or so. Uh-huh. But we helped build the arch, all those things.
By looking out the window, you mean.
That's right. I'll watch the last piece go in. When I started, we worked in the old print shop.
I see.
And,
is that part of the existing grounds of Ralston Purina? Mm-hmm.
Yes, all the buildings have been all rehabilitated. Of course, after the big fire, they did some extra building.
Uh-huh. She was there when Daddy Danforth, who was really quite a man, who started the company, and was called Daddy Danforth mm-hmm. by most of the people because he knew everybody. And, presidents of companies don't anymore. But.
He had visited in Paul's home out in Peking.
I see.
On one of his trips to China.
Is not the present chancellor of the university, his son?
Mm-hmm. Grandson.
Grandson, okay.
Yes.
But the elder Daddy Danforth, as you call him, did have a long...
Oh, yes.
Interest in medicine and philanthropy. And
mm-hmm. He was his own man.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful person.
Well, I think he was a friend of Dr. Cowdery's, because I have pictures, I think, of meetings that Danforth sponsored, and that Cowdery was the beneficiary of some grants from the Danforth mm-hmm. Foundation mm-hmm. that involved the mm-hmm. elder man. Well, retirement, back to Paul Stevenson, retirement began again in 1960, and then what was life like that?
He came here then,
uh-huh.
and we established a home in Skinker, a large apartment there. We brought the things from Baltimore, and we lived there until he died.
I see. This is one of the large apartment buildings mm-hmm. on the south side of the...
Well, it's right across from the, it's on the west side of Forest Park there on
uh-huh.
Skinker.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
One of the older buildings, large apartments. So that the furniture, the Baltimore apartment was a very large one that had been, it was a building that had been built by Eastern Shore millionaires who wanted a place in Baltimore for the winter. An old fashioned apartment. The elevator was lined with mirrors and had a bench on which you sat while someone took you up.
Oh my.
And I wasn't used to that kind of coddling, and I remember once coming in with a package, and the doorman was horrified that I would be carrying a package. I don't mean it weighed more than a pound and a half or so, but took it from me and insisted on taking it up and taking it all the way into the house and depositing it wherever I thought it should go. It was just not right for a lady to carry any kind of a package. Nothing ever had to be locked because the doorman would not send anyone up until they knew, had found out that they were welcome guests.
Uh-huh.
And doors were never locked in the building. And it was a very interesting place.
I see. Yeah. You mentioned that during the retirement years, you did some traveling in national parks and were interested mm-hmm. in nature. And
uh-huh. And Paul was really such a wonderful man. He had, in all those years that he was working, basically in China, he had never had a vacation and had never taken a trip anywhere as a tourist. He had been around the world two or three times, but it had always been because he had something to do in one of those places. So being retired and having time to do whatever he wanted to do, quite an experience for him. And he proceeded to fill it with all the interests he could find. Became very interested in music, and he did that before we were married. He had gotten himself a Fisher phonograph, his records. And then he extended that to rocks and birds and plants and everything of that sort. And we traveled with him, a carload of books, and argued over every type of rock, every kind of tree, every kind of bird or flower.
Uh-huh.
We
came home with a car full of rocks, as
we
I recall.
Did. Uh-huh. it was very interesting. We waited till Lucy retired, and then had all the plans for that trip, and we spent about 3.5 or 4 months, I guess, through the West, and we stayed wherever we wanted to stay, and found out all we could about
uh-huh.
it. Went to all of the museums, I'm sure.
And the libraries.
Whole area, all the libraries, and all of the universities. I don't think we missed any large one. He knew somebody in all of those,
uh-huh.
of course.
Uh-huh.
He had a very remarkable man. He had quite a wonderful mind. I was so interested in the fact that we could go into a city like San Francisco or Seattle or somewhere, and he already knew his way around more or less, but he would look at a map and decide where it was we should go the next day, and he would know exactly where to go. The map would, he wouldn't refer to it again. He could remember
uh-huh.
all the streets and all the turns uh-huh. and all the places.
Uh-huh. Well, it was probably child's play after negotiating through Chinese cities.
I guess so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But still, they were different.
Uh-huh.
But he's one of those people who could, if he did ask directions from a policeman, and the policeman would tell him 15 different turns, you know, and by that time I don't know where I'm going, and he would repeat it word for word afterward.
Uh-huh. He had a remarkable memory, too. You describe mm-hmm. a trip to England where
yeah.
he was able to
mm-hmm.
locate places
yeah.
where he had been
yeah.
Yeah.
Found
decades before.
Yeah. Wow.
Uh-huh. Well, is there anything else that we haven't covered that should be?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm very appreciative of your time that you've both given and the number of reminiscences that you've shared with me in this. And I tend to, of course, add this to the collection, if you'll agree, and in the future, someone well like myself would be interested in the career of Paul Stevenson. So
these come back to you, do they?
Yes, if I may. I just made copies
yes.
of the pictures
mm-hmm.
that will appear in the
yeah.
Outlook
mm-hmm.
article about his time in China. So, well, this point, I'll sign off and with thanks once again for speaking with me.
Mm-hmm.